Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by the Growth Platform Framework. B2B FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@ipractitioners.com. Now, over to the show with Richard Dozy, founder and host.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Today on the show, we have Tom van der Loop, co-founder of Vigi. Hey, Tom, great to have you on the show. How are things going today?
Thank you very much. Nice for having me. Everything is very well, beautiful weather here. So I'm in a very good mood and looking forward to our talk.
Great. I mean, let's start the show by telling us a bit about yourself and your background.
I have, let's say, for the financial industry, perhaps a little bit of an exotic background. I am a historian. I studied international law in Leiden in the Netherlands, politics, history, this kind of stuff, and to become a diplomat when I was at the university. But I found out that for me, it's difficult to defend certain opinions which are not mine. After having studied abroad, I studied in Paris, in Berlin, I ended up in consultancy and afterwards in the financial sector. I'm an entrepreneur since a little bit more than 10 years for Vigi. We do mortgage advice. So that's a small introduction. Perhaps one private sentence as well. I'm 52. I have two very small children. As I'm a very old father, so to say, I'm enjoying that very much. And my life is mainly about working, and then the other half is family. That's probably my life, my introduction.
Great. And, you know, I think it's important to also, very important to also have that sort of work-life balance and make certain you spend time with your family, especially when it's when they're young and growing up. But, you know, I know we're going to be talking about scaling and leadership today. Maybe we can kick off with you talking us through your approach to scaling and leadership, because I know it isn't always a path spoken about or well-traveled. And maybe more importantly, how do you characterize your mission with regards to your philosophy?
I think I should start by saying our company, it starts with purpose. So probably a lot of people know this book of Simon Sinek, why he has brought this topic back on the table, I think, in a very popular way, but it's much older. So in the end, everything we do is about what's the reason why we do things we do, and raison d'être. What's our reason to exist, so to say? And that's probably the starting point. And sometimes we forget about that. And that's something which you see in times of crisis, which comes back. We'll probably dive into that later. And the purpose of the company is twofold. On the one hand, we want to change the financial sector, specifically to start with the mortgage advice. And the other thing is, and that's more organizational topic, we want to change the way we work by doing this in a different way, like most companies do. And that's the whole topic of self-organization, holacracy, etc. And we'll also probably come later to that topic as well.
Maybe we can go into that a bit now. I mean, what is your philosophy around, you know, self-organization, growing a business, and also how does that play out in times of crisis?
If you take this purpose, which is a starting point, then the next topic is what is the hierarchy of your stakeholders, to put it in a more, let's say, management way of discussing things. And we always started with our own people. So it's start with the purpose, then it's called people first, and that means our own people, clients second, shareholders third, or shareholders last. And that creates a very good hierarchy, if you talk about hierarchy of the ranking of those interests of the different stakeholders. And if you then see in times of crisis, for instance, what's going on at the moment, that if you are in a shareholder value-driven structure, then you have a different hierarchy. Then it's the shareholder first, and you have to keep up profits, or you have to downsize the company as fast as possible to support your stock price, and then you're starting to lay off people. So we have to realize that it always starts with your values and your hierarchy of stakeholders. And then all the stuff which is done afterwards just follows this kind of hierarchy. That's the main topic, that our solidarity always is at our core of our company. And to also to give you a very simple practical example, which we had to defend in the last 10 years before the COVID crisis was there, where there were always two discussions that we were always asked, why don't you put your clients first? Because then there are a lot of examples like Amazon and all these others. And then we said, because it's about being human in the core of what we're doing, and we don't understand why we should serve clients during the weekend or late in the evening when people also have time to go to the gym or to go to the dentist. So why would a client not be able to make an appointment, doesn't matter if it's virtual or let's say in the office, at a normal time during the day? Because our people also have families, they also have private lives. So we don't advise clients during the weekend. We don't advise clients during the evening, and it works pretty well. And the other aspect is about shareholders. We were often asked why we don't grow faster, why we don't get a lot of private equity into the company. And then the answer always was, we want to be owners of our own company as long as possible to be able to decide what we think is right for the company.
You mentioned a number of things, and it sounds like, you know, from the purpose to the hierarchy to the solidarity at its core, you're building an ecosystem, and that ecosystem is built around trust.
Yeah, that's correct.
How does that play out practically in sort of your day-to-day operations and maybe longer term your visions and goals?
Yeah, perhaps I have to explain that I also have studied economics, but let's say if it's really about the core or the matter of things, in the end, you always go back to philosophical discussions, things that really matter. And we have, for instance, only one rule in the company. That's the golden rule. Treat other people like you wanted to be treated yourself. And you can adapt this rule to everything you do in the company. So if it's towards clients or suppliers or the environment or paying taxes, etc., it's always what would I expect when I would be on the other side of the table. And it works pretty well. And it sounds very simple, but in the end, most things are very simple. We make things very complicated or we talk around topics. But in the end, also, for instance, solidarity is very simple, and it's at the core of our being human. And that's what you also see in times of crisis, but you also see it in the language. We see, let's say, altruistic behavior, helping others. We see this as something positive, and behaving in an egoistic way, we see as a society or also as human beings, we see this as a negative thing. If you then adapt this language to shareholder value-driven economy or our system, then it's very clear that behaving in an egoistic way, which is, let's say, something which shareholder value capitalism does, it only cares about the own profits and not about other stakeholders. That's something we normally would not accept. But by using different words, we try to avoid this kind of clear discussion going on. And you have the same with human resources. So the word resources is something which, if you are the resource, is a word you wouldn't like. You want to be treated as a human being, and you want to be treated with respect, and you want to be supported in difficult times. There's also something which you want to have. You want to be treated by your friends, and you want to be helped by your friends when you are in problems. You don't want to laid off in a friendship by your friends when you just go through a divorce or when you're sick. So I would say, in the end, everything is very simple and everything is very clear. But the difficult thing is to be clear on our values and what is right and what is wrong.
Some important and interesting insights there. I mean, you mentioned human resources. I mean, you know, maybe human capital, we can also refer to it as. But, you know, in this style of leading a company, what is the impact on your workforce? I mean, they are self-organizing, they are, you know, value-driven, purpose-driven. But, you know, again, what is the impact across teams as you drive forward on this mission?
You have a strong discussion going on since also before COVID crisis about psychological safety. Perhaps some of your listeners are known with the Aristotle project of Google. And Google did this research because they wanted to find out why are certain teams more productive than others. Now, just to start with the conclusion, it's about psychological safety. So if people feel safe in their environments and they're able to share their questions or they want to criticize each other or they want to search together for the best solution, you have the highest performance. The framing is interesting because people always search for the highest performance and then they find out that treating each other, let's say, equally or respectfully creates the highest output. So I would say there you are again back at the start, that if you treat each other in a respectful way and people feel safe, your productivity is also much higher. So if you just take the COVID crisis as an example, as a company, you have two possibilities. You can say, okay, I will try to avoid as long as possible any layoffs, and I will try as owners to put money into the company as long as possible because I know how difficult it has been to build up this company, which is a typical behavior of small and medium-sized enterprises. Or the other possibility is I just don't care. I'm short-term oriented. And by pronouncing that I will do layoffs, the investors which are sitting around the world anonymously keeping their shares for 3 months, they will react in a positive way because they know that in the short term, the profits are stabilized. And these are the two options you have. So, but if you decide for the first option I just described, then in the long term, you will have a healthier company, but also higher returns and a higher shareholder value. So that's something which I find so interesting, that it's not that if you behave in a human way, you are punished by that, by doing, let's say, from a business point of view, not so well. And those companies who behave egoistically, they do much better in an economic way. Now, that's not the case. That makes the discussion so interesting.
Yeah, everyone wants to go out when they're scaling up, you know, they're trying to solve a problem. They want to go out and they want to get the best talent in inverted commas. And, you know, they get the best talent and they bring it into the organization in some instances, depending on how the company set up. That talent is filtered into a silo. And actually what transpires is there's no output across the teams because everyone's working in silo, everyone's doing their own things. I mean, what you're saying here is, well, let's look at it slightly differently. Let's go, we've got a team, we've got a company, let's have a culture. And when we go out and hire, you know, in inverted commas, the best talent, they mean to embed themselves into our team, our philosophy and our rhythm so that the team as a whole, not the silos, get results together.
Yeah, the topic or the slogan you always have, hire for culture, not for skills. But also to frame it in a little bit from a different angle, the interesting thing is that if you ask CEOs or CFOs what is the competitive advantage they have as a company, the only answer they always give is their people. And if you then see how people are treated, and especially something which you see at the moment during times of crisis, then the question is, how can you give an answer and telling that people is the most important decisive factor for your competitive advantage, and in the end also of being able to survive in comparison to your competitors? And the other way, you treat people in a way where, let's say, everybody understands that if you would be treated like that, that you would search for another job, or at least after the crisis would search for another job. So that's something which is very strange. And you also see this in the organizations itself, that the role of the CFO or CEO is pretty strong and decisive. And HR, where it is about, if it is about well-being of people, is something which is not treated on an equal level. So that's what I also find very interesting, that you have a lot of research which shows that if you treat your people well and you build up strong culture, that you will be building a much stronger company. But we don't, let's say, reflect on that in practice. So I always wonder if people read those articles in Harvard Business Review who are, let's say, managing these big corporations, and then why are they doing exactly the opposite? I mean, I know the answer because it's where they have their shareholders, but it's still interesting that you read the articles, but you don't implement it in practice.
Yeah, that continues to happen, I guess. And, you know, as maybe a different approach to some of my listeners out. I mean, we've mentioned that one of the approaches that you use to build in this culture and philosophy is treat others like you treat yourself. What are the other, you know, methods you use at FEG to embed this culture and philosophy on an ongoing basis?
Let's say it's a big puzzle. So it's always difficult because you take, let's say, a few pieces out, depending on, let's say, the topic of the interview. But in the end, it's huge complexity because you have a lot of puzzle pieces and they all fit together and you can't just take one. So if you talk about agility or if you talk about self-organization, because that's more efficient, then you shouldn't forget about the other pieces of the puzzle. But just to mention a few, the values we already discussed pretty profoundly. Then we have a homegrown culture. So all the advisors, we are not a huge company, we're 50 people, but all the advisors who advise clients, they are all what we call homegrown. So they come from university or have a few years of work experience. And then we educate them in our company. Of the advisors we have, nobody has ever advised for a bank. So, and that also creates a strong culture. On the other hand is, let's say, the back office. People who are in the credit department and this kind of, let's say, functions or roles, those people are all hired with an enormous amount of experience. So those people have more than 10 years experience. So we value the experience. It always depends. It's more complex than just saying hire young and develop them. No, it depends on which department people work at. The other aspect I already mentioned, we're always for the long term, but that's easier because we still own the company. We're not pushed by quarterly results. And that also gives us the flexibility to the anti-cyclical strategy. So for instance, for us, this COVID crisis has also very positive sides because we can hire more easily. So we would decide when there are opportunities, it's not important to have high profits. No, then you should use this opportunity to invest all those profits in hiring people you normally can't hire that easily. Or we doubled our marketing budgets during the crisis. That's exactly the opposite what a lot of companies do. So in the end, it's a very complex puzzle with a lot of pieces. But in the end, I would say the common thing is that it's all common sense. So it's all common sense. It's not higher management's philosophy. I would say that all those small and medium-sized enterprises try to show solidarity to their people. They know how difficult it has been to build up their companies. They use opportunities. And for them, it's much more about the long term than the short term.
As it is a model where your teams self-organize, I mean, it would be good to, you know, get some insight as to how that actually plays out in times of crisis. I mean, we're obviously going through one right now. Do you have a case study or an example that you can share with us that brings this self-organization and culture to life for our listeners?
I always try to explain things as much as possible and to keep things simple. People are not familiar with this whole idea of self-organization. I want to tell or to say that it's not more difficult than, or we shouldn't make it more difficult than it is. What happens in the end in a self-organizing structure is that functions are split into roles, and those roles are very clear described what the responsibilities and the goals of those roles are and who is responsible for the role. In our company, you can also see this from an external perspective. So if you Google Visi or my name and Glassrock, the software of Holacracy, then you can just find our whole organizational structure and you can see what roles I have in the company. And they're all described with the accountabilities. And because it's so clear and those roles are adapted and adjusted all the times, it's totally clear who is responsible for what. And that means that in times of crisis, it doesn't matter if you sit together in an office or is everybody sitting at home, because it's still clear what the roles are and who is responsible for which role. So their hierarchy is, because often it's said now a self-organization doesn't have hierarchy, I would say the opposite. If you would define hierarchy with it's clear where responsibility is, and it doesn't matter if it's horizontal or vertical, then the self-organization structures are much clearer and much stricter because it's very clearly described who is responsible. So you can't have a discussion, we're all responsible. And I thought somebody else would be taking care of the topic. And that helps in times of crisis because there it's clearer that you're not in the same room and everybody should know exactly who is doing what. But the underlying basic starting point is that everybody should feel, let's say, safe. So the first thing we did in the first week of the lockdown was by saying it's about solidarity and we'll try to avoid layoffs as long as possible. I mean, we grew in the crisis, but that's the starting point. And then people have their 100% of productivity to take care of their roles. And when I speak to a lot of self-organizing companies, a lot of companies tell that they have become more productive during times of crisis.
Self-organization, I mean, it seems drive accountability, make that very clear, and is obviously quite empowering. People are able to clearly see what they need to do, and they are empowered to get on with this and move things forward.
And there's also another aspect, which is, I think, very important. We also have to concept of radical transparency. I mean, we have not invented it. Radical transparency comes from the parliament. You can just Google it on Wikipedia. And that means that information you need, and then let's say in the society, it's about the citizens or just we living in societies. We want to know what's going on and what is discussed in parliament. There it comes from radical transparency, but it also has a very positive effect in companies. So independent of, let's say, these crises, everybody always knows where to find what information, and that can be on the one hand who is responsible for what, and then people just call each other and say, I want to decide on this topic, I see you also play a role in this topic, shall we discuss, and then I know what to decide. But it also has to do with all the figures, all the dashboards, etc. Everything is open, so everybody can search for the information, and then that's clear that if everybody is doing this and everybody has this access to all this information, you have a much higher speed. It doesn't stop because people are still able to get the information they need for their decisions to go on. So that's something I think which makes it very understandable how the system works.
What about the commitment elements? I mean, you know, you mentioned quite an interesting use case whereby you spoke to your team during or at the beginning of the initial crisis or the pandemic and said, listen, we are okay. We're not going to lay off anyone right now. We're going to make certain that we look after you, that we're in this together. I mean, surely that means the team are going to be committed to the cause. And during that, you know, maybe crisis, the commitment stays and maybe productivity goes up.
Yeah, it goes up. But it is, let's say, it's also something, let's say, if you come back to this hierarchy of stakeholders, we always had a situation where people had access to our financial figures. So people know how much cash there is in the company. Now, since the COVID crisis, it's, let's say, actively shared every week on a Thursday. That's our town hall. It only takes half an hour. And there's always the figures, always the numbers. But they're all in our Slack channels as well. So everybody can see this whenever they want. And they can see, okay, we have so much liquidity or so much cash. And that's something which creates a lot of rest. But the other thing is also that we said, and we also have done this in the past, that we as shareholders are willing to put private money into the company if this would be necessary. So it's about people first, clients second, shareholders come last. But if it's about the obligation towards the company, then shareholders come first. So we had situations in the past where we had problems with our cash situation and we didn't pay our own salaries as founders. We are 4 co-founders. We didn't pay our own salaries, but paid the salaries of our people. And if you do this for a longer time and if you walk the talk, it's not only about let's put something on the wall, which we believe in if everything goes well. And if there is a crisis, we behave in a different way. Now, if you really walk the talk and you show this again and again and again, then this becomes part of your DNA. Because younger people, they will ask older colleagues, that's very nice, that's very interesting, they tell this, but do they really walk the talk when it comes to the decisive point where shareholders have to act? And I think that's in the end, I mean, you can tell a lot of interesting stories and you can put a lot of interesting stuff on the wall, but in the end, it's about what do you do when it's necessary? And then you have excellent examples where owners put money into the company again, or I just posted 2 or 3 weeks ago, Southwest Airlines, I mean, even airline industry, where the CEO just cut his salary to zero and said, no, we want to try to avoid also layoffs in 2021. So that's the way you build great companies.
Yeah, and I guess that's also, you know, let's walk the talk. I mean, that's ultimately what you guys are doing there is you continuously upholding the values of your company.
Yeah, but it's also, for instance, let's say we as shareholders, we have exactly the same salary as our own people. So we don't have a multiple of our salaries. We just say we have different roles. We have our role in the company, like anybody else, and we have our shareholder role. And if we, let's say, would be in the end successful, or I don't know, I mean, we are just doing this for 10 years now, but we're just part of the team as all the other colleagues are as well. So, and all these salaries are also transparent. So it's not about having principles, but then not behaving in that way. So if you talk a lot about, let's say, that you're a people-driven company, then in times of crisis, you're not cutting your own CEO salary to start with, and you're still negotiating your bonuses, then you don't have to speak to your people anymore, because people will just say, I just don't believe you because what you tell me is not the way you behave. So in the end, it's not very difficult, because everybody understands immediately that if somebody has earned a lot of money in the past as a CEO, that the CEO has to act first and say, okay, I've cut my salary by 50%, and now we're going to discuss if we can cut all the salaries of all the people working here by 10%. And that's exactly what the Southwest CEO did. And that makes this person, let's say, a good leader and a good example.
Yeah, I think, I mean, behavior is how you go about your daily life and your daily business. It has to uphold your values, right? I mean, it's so important. And, you know, how does your philosophy and culture and values, how does that impact or play a role with your clients and in your customers?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because we had before COVID a lot of, as I said before, in a lot of interviews, we always had the question, do your clients accept this? And the funny thing is, they do, but it's more for another reason than we expected they would do. And that is because they also work in companies, and they just, this mental experience that they say, I also would like to be treated like my advisor is treated in the company I just talked to. So the interesting thing is that 25% of the people we hire are former clients. But it's also, let's say, from a normal common sense point of view, it's just very normal. If you work, let's say, in an extreme example, in a warehouse for Amazon, etc., and somebody can click at Amazon Prime 1 minute before 24 hours before somebody goes to bed, and somebody could have ordered this product 3 weeks ago but didn't, and then clicks before he goes to bed, and there's a family father of two running through this warehouse at 2 o'clock at the night so that I the next day will have this parcel delivered, that's normal that somebody who has to work in this kind of working circumstances doesn't like this in the long run. Perhaps it's nice as a student if you have a totally different life, but these are inhumane. This is an inhumane working environment. So if you then at our company and you ask, can I have my advice in the evening or Saturday? And then we explain no, then there is this reflection going on that people say, oh, that's also something I would really like in my company, because I also have a family and want to, let's say, have the privilege, or I mean, it's not even a privilege, but the normal situation that at a certain point I can just close my laptop and be together with my family.
Yeah, yeah, it's so important. And what questions should fintech leaders be asking, or factors they should be considering as they scale and lead bigger teams? What are the things that you think would help them through that journey?
depends on what situation you are. So, and let's say for us, with the huge mortgage market in the Netherlands and growing the company organically, it's much easier than if it would be a CEO of a stock-listed company. So you always have to, let's say, separate things from each other. But if you, let's say, if you are a startup or a scale-up, I think the starting point should be that you realize, why are you an entrepreneur? Why do you build this company? And we in the beginning had this discussion. I worked together with my co-founders for 20 years now. So we know each other from an old corporate where we work together. And if you have a very clear understanding or common understanding, what are your goals and what is your purpose? It's very simple, because then in times of crisis, you still know why you're doing what you're doing. So the starting point for us was never to be, let's say, financially successful or to become rich. Then, for instance, I should have stayed at McKinsey just after my studies. That would have been much more easy with less risk. So the starting point is very, very important. If you start for the purpose, it's much easier to continue. And then if you are in a mid-sized company or in a huge company, it depends very, very much on the circumstances. So if you are stock listed, it's clear that in the end, it's very difficult to change, let's say, your strategy, because if you would stand there and say it's about solidarity, we're not going to lay off people, then your shareholders will call you and say, sorry, but we didn't hire you to lower my profits because I'm the owner of the company, so please change your message. So it's also a problem of in which system you're active. And young people, and that's what you just see, this Daniel Pink purpose discussion, younger people are probably, if they have good chances of getting jobs, they will decide more and more towards jobs where they feel or they find fulfillment. It's not about money. It's not only about money. So it's a mix of purpose and money. So I think if you are a fintech leader, be aware that the best people come for purpose.
Yeah, some really great and valuable insights then. Obviously, part of being an entrepreneur and a leader is continuously learning. And in that vein, what book or podcast or media right now are you listening to or reading that you think of value for the wider community?
Oh, that really depends on the topic. So let's say if people are interested in, let's say, organizational stuff or salaries, etc., they can just Google my name, and then depends on, let's say, where you live and what language area. There are excellent podcasts in the UK. I think about Richard Edderton, Being Human. There are more, Elisa Gill. There's a lot of interesting podcasts, for instance. And if it comes to books, just to give a different, let's say, answer, is that I think we should read less business books and much more books about history, about philosophy, etc., because it gives you a different reflection. So the more you read about Steve Jobs and Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, etc., we don't leave our mental box that it's all about financial success. But we should try to, let's say, go back to the basics. And then if you see it from a historical point of view, I would say start with the end in mind. How would you decide if you only have 3 months to live, what is really important, or how do you want to be seen by your environment? And that changes your scope in a very drastic way. And that's, I think, in business is the biggest problem at the moment, that we don't realize that we are reading all the time the same crap with the same short-term financially oriented goals. And that doesn't mean that as an entrepreneur, and that's also for us, we want to be successful. We want to be market leader. We want to grow our revenues. But that's a result of a value-oriented business approach, and that's not the starting point.
Yeah, so some really valuable points there. And as we wrap up the show, how can people find you and get in touch with you?
I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, and everybody who wants to connect, feel free to do so. There, everything we do in our company or all the experience we have, we share them openly. So we don't have any secrets besides, let's say, client data we don't share, but all the stuff is open. So if people find things interesting, just Google the stuff. And I just want to make one remark. The more podcasts and the more interviews and the more articles I do, the more specific questions I get. And I always answer, that's just on the web. So then just Google VC and the topic, because most of the time you will find one or two articles or podcasts where, let's say, in a very profound way, the stuff is explained. Like we just talked, I don't know, half an hour or three quarters of an hour. So there's an enormous amount of information on the internet. And I want, or I try to focus on writing articles or giving podcasts, because then it's much more accessible to a bigger audience, so to say. Although I also want to stress that it's not about us and it's not about me. I think that the general small or medium-sized enterprises behaves exactly the way I just described.
It's been brilliant. I mean, I've really enjoyed the conversation and it's opened my eyes to a few new methods. So thanks for being on the show today and talking through your experience and giving us a bit of an insight into how to lead in times of crisis and how to build a company around self-organization.
Thank you for having me.